You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1916, the British made a secret agreement with the French that would give them southern Mesopotamia, including Baghdad, at the conclusion of World War I. Earlier this year, I spoke with Barry Lando, author of Web of Deceit, a history of Western complicity in Iraq from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush, which looks into the mostly negative impact of British, French, American, and Russian interventions in Iraq over the past 90 years. In the light of the current situation in Iraq, we thought it would be a good time to replay that interview today. I started out by asking Barry Lando what led the British and French to make the secret agreement that would result in the creation of Iraq.
Well, ultimately that agreement fell apart when it became public. But what they were both after at the time was bases in that area and taking advantage of the collapse of the Turkish Empire, which was collapsing in the wake of World War I.
And also, had oil been discovered at that point?
Oil had just been discovered, not in Iraq. People thought there might be deposits there because the British were already pumping oil in Iran, Persia. So the British were very interested in that part of the world for petroleum and for bases, because bases for their empire, Persia, India, and so on. And it's really not that much different from the United States today.
Well, today there's a lot of talk about Iraq really being three countries, although nobody knows how to implement that as a possible solution. How were its boundaries determined?
Its boundaries were determined by taking three provinces of the Turkish Empire and putting them together in one. And these were actually administrative provinces that existed under the Turks, but they were not forced to live in one country as they were when the British took over.
To some degree, this is similar to what happened in parts of Africa, where people who had little in common were often grouped together into a country called Nigeria.
Exactly. At the time, Winston Churchill was one of the top cabinet members already back then, and at the time, the British were warned, if you try to put these three peoples together, the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds, it's a recipe for disaster. They were told that back then. In fact, some of the warnings, again, sound like they could have been repeated today.
Churchill also was quoted as saying that elections were, and I'm quoting, scarcely worthy of the name in so scattered and primitive a community.
Exactly. They set up kind of fake elections in order to set up Faisal, who was the first king, who was imported into Iraq from the Gulf. He had never been to Iraq before and to what became Iraq, but the British were looking for a figurehead to run this operation, to run this new colony, if you will.
And why did Churchill think Faisal was the man for the job?
Well, he was pushed by Lawrence of Arabia was in this. It's a whole kind of a romantic story, and they had taken part in the fight against the Germans. So there was kind of awards being passed out afterwards.
Well, we've heard a lot about there being no democratic tradition in this part of the world. Was there ever a time when somebody thought it might be a good idea to try to develop democratic institutions?
I think back then no one was thinking about that. It was simply a question of how do we put this thing together. They had the Americans kind of watching over their shoulder. There was Woodrow Wilson there who was talking about the right of nations, self-determination. In fact, they had even promised the Kurds back then that they would give their Kurds an autonomous state. They went back very quickly on their promise when they found out that the Kurds had a lot of petroleum, and the British wanted that petroleum to be part of the new Iraq. So they incorporated Kurdistan into this new country simply to get hold of that petroleum.
Was there ever a time when creating a democracy in Iraq was a serious goal, at least before the Bush administration made claims with Operation Iraqi Freedom?
I don't think it's ever been a serious goal of anyone, including George Bush.
Did anyone consider the implications of cobbling together peoples and tribes in one nation with such complex and troubled relations?
They did consider it, and they were warned not to try to do it. And after the first revolt took place in 1920, in other words, as soon as these peoples found out what the British had in mind for them, not to let them become independent, but to British were given a mandate over them, the Shiites, the Sunnis, some of the Kurds, they arose immediately in rebellion. And they were put, the rebellion was put down by the Royal Air Force, essentially, using bombs, machine guns, destroying these tribal villages. The people, of course, had no way to fight back against these kinds of weapons. And Churchill at one point even suggested that it might be more effective if the RAF also considered using chemical weapons back then.
You write that from the time of the establishment of the modern nation of Iraq, foreign powers consistently prevented Iraqis from taking responsibility for their own destiny.
Correct.
So, okay, so they have Prince Faisal bin Hussein al Hashemite of Saudi Arabia as their king, and then he dies in 1933.
Right.
Had he kept the country together at all?
He had kept the country together. He had kind of a feeling of he wanted, although it wasn't his country of origin, he had this feeling that he would like to have created a country there, to have created a new state. And the British were constantly undermining his powers. What the British wanted, they wanted their bases, and they wanted the petroleum. And they essentially cut the Iraqis out of any real profits in the petroleum that they began to pump, and they had their bases. And they controlled the country's foreign policy, its finances, and that continued after him as well.
When Ghazi, his son, took over.
Right.
So the kings really were semi-powerless.
Well, they were semi-powerless, but every time they tried anything, Ghazi, who followed, was a very weird kind of individual. He was not, I mean, he was a very strange leader, but he also became something of an Iraqi nationalist. He tried to get, again, more of the petroleum rights for the country, and he tried to speak for Arabs across, outside of Iraq as well. This upset the British. He even made a stab at reclaiming Kuwait, because Saddam was not the first person, not the first Iraqi leader to want Kuwait back. The
Iraqis, Saddam said that it had been a province of Iraq. Of course, Iraq was a construct anyway, so it seemed like a silly argument. But is there some historical reason
to
understand that?
At that time, the Kuwait was part of one of the Turkish provinces that became part of Iraq. So every Iraqi school child, perhaps even today, learns that Kuwait was part of their heritage.
My guest is Barry M. Lando. His book, Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. It is published by Other Press. What about religion? Because under the Ba'ath Party, it was a relatively secular country, but Saudis have tended to be more religious than other people in the Middle East. Was that the case with Faisal and then Ghazi?
No, I think people were fairly religious there. I mean, they were the Shiites, which of course were a totally different form of Islam than the Sunnis, but still, I think the people were generally religious. The Ba'ath Party, of course, grew up later, but it was a very small party, and they were secular, and I think that's what attracted the United States to them as well.
Ghazi died, and his infant son was made king.
Right.
And then how long did that last?
That lasted for about 5 or 6 years until he became of age. But the British were always behind the scenes. They were always through their, if you will, kind of puppet leaders in Iraq, Iraqi politicians who they made use of. They tried to stay on top. And again, the main thing again was bases, petroleum.
So the British were behind the military coups and dictatorships that followed the rule of Faisal II?
You know, there was a lot of turbulence. I think there were something like 15 changes of government. It was a very chaotic period, but somehow the British managed to oversee the whole thing, to stay on top, to stay out of the local politics. As long as they could rule from afar, that's what they wanted.
Did anything positive come out of this? Were any of those military dictatorships better than others?
Frankly, I don't think so. There was turmoil, and you repeatedly had military coming to power, the military were quite nationalistic as well. When they did take power in one coup in 1941, the British reacted by basically reinvading the country and so, reoccupying Iraq.
So when did Iraq achieve independence?
They never really achieved independence. I mean, they were the British left. It was 1934. Then they came back, but then they reoccupied the country again. And they never really achieved independence because the British kept their bases there and they kept the petroleum. The petroleum was the key thing.
I mean, this is even after World War II?
Yeah. The British always, it was the British petroleum, the British continued to control the petroleum of Iraq. And that was the key thing for the economy.
So were they still in control when the Ba'ath Party took over?
No. What happened was you had a military coup and a General Qassam came in. And he played off the West against the Soviets because at that period with the Cold War going on, the only way to really achieve any kind of independence is a lot of neutralist leaders, Sukarno and others, felt you had to play the Soviet hand as well and ask them for aid. He tried to get more control of Iraq's petroleum deposits. In order to do that, he invited in the Soviets to help him to help exploit the petroleum because the International Petroleum Cartel warned the Iraqis, if you take us over, no one's going to help you market your petroleum.
Now, next door was Iran,
right,
where the United States was involved in the overthrow of
Mossadegh. Right.
And so that must have been something that the Iraqis paid a lot of attention to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In 1953, the U.S. overthrew Mossadegh, who had also been trying to get a greater share of petroleum for Iran.
Now, why has it been a Sunni-ruled country, even though the majority of the population is Shiite? Is that something that goes all the way back to the British making Prince Faisal the king?
But, well, it goes back, actually, to the Turks, who made use of the Sunnis in Iraq tended to be city dwellers, more educated. The Shiites were living more in the southern part of the country. So afterwards, the Sunnis continued basically to control, under the British, to control Iraq.
So the British are pretty much the, if we want to see villains, of at least they are the Western power with the most impact. But then we see a lot of different people getting involved. Jacques Chirac, Leonid Brezhnev, Mikhail Gorbachev, and then American presidents. You specifically point to Kennedy, Carter, Clinton, Reagan, and the Bushes. Not Johnson, Nixon.
Oh, no. I've tried to bracket, but in fact, I think one could say if every American president from Eisenhower to the present, every one of them, in a way, has played a somewhat cynical hand in Iraq. It's hard to think of anyone who could not be nailed for something.
And when we come back from a little break, we'll talk about the cynical hand played when Saddam began to hint that he might invade Kuwait. My guest is Barry M. Lando, a former producer for 60 Minutes, the author of numerous articles about Iraq, also produced a documentary about Saddam Hussein. His book, Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. Stay with us. We're back with Barry M. Lando, L-A-N-D-O, his book, Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. It is published by Other Press. We were talking about some of the American presidents involved. Well, Eisenhower was the president at the time of the overthrow of Mossadegh. What was he doing with Iraq?
Well, there was the Cold War, of course, going on, and they viewed in 1959... they viewed a military leader who had come into power in Iraq called Qassam as an enemy of the United States because he had gone to look for support to the Soviets as well in trying to run kind of a neutralist policy, if you will. And
that was the time of the Third World Movement.
Exactly.
Tito and Sukarno.
Right. So he came to power in 1958 and began to act like a nationalist, wanting more resources for Iraq and, as I said, collaborating to some degree with the Soviet Union as well. He was regarded as an enemy in the United States. You were either for us or against us back then. And so the CIA with the Egyptian police and others plotted to assassinate him. To do that, they used some young members of the Ba'ath Party. And one of the young thugs they used at that time was Saddam Hussein, was maybe 20, 21 years old. And that was the first time that he really began his rise to prominence with that assassination attempt.
How long before he became the number one man in Iraq?
Well, he really became the number one man about in 1968.
But so that about was, 10, 12, or
yeah,
15
but that was
years
after
later.
There was a coup and a couple more coups. And the Ba'ath came back to power in 1968. Saddam was behind the scenes, but very early on he was regarded as the number one man.
Would anyone reading this book conclude that you're a Saddam Hussein apologist?
I certainly hope not. I mean, there's plenty in there that describes the atrocities, the brutality, the ruthlessness of Saddam Hussein. But what we've forgotten is to what degree we, the United States, was complicit with that, knowing full well what kind of a man Saddam was.
So was hanging a justifiable punishment, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm not for the death penalty, but he deserved whatever he got.
But you've also said that you would put Western leaders on trial for some of the crimes that Saddam committed.
Absolutely. They were complicit in things they did and things they didn't do. With a lot of those crimes. And what I find remarkable is that today, people may not realize it, but the trials are still going on in Baghdad, even without Saddam. Right now he's being put on trial for his followers were being put on trial for the slaughter of the Kurds in 1988, and that trial is still going on. And yet you will not read a single mention in our mainstream press, at least I haven't, that gives any indication of the complicity of the United States in that particular genocide.
Where does Jimmy Carter fit into this story?
Jimmy Carter gave a green light to Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. It was given to Saddam Hussein via the Saudis, but it was given by Jimmy Carter.
Because he was so angry with what the Iranians had done with the capture of the embassy, the holding
right.
of the hostages.
Khomeini was regarded as basically he was the black threat back then.
So was this a matter of the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
Exactly. And so they supported, the U.S. supported Saddam, as did many other countries, for 8 years. That was the longest war of the last century. It resulted in at least 1 million people dying on both sides.
What evidence do you have for your claim that the CIA artificially prolonged that war?
The CIA gave, the U.S. sold arms to both sides. They also gave intelligence information to both sides. They played a back-and-forth game as that war was going on, as Washington did. If one side seemed to be winning, they then switched and tried to balance and give arms and aid to the other side. They didn't want either party to really come out ahead.
And the war ended in a kind of a stalemate, or I guess Saddam really lost the war.
Saddam at the end was considered the victor. I mean, Khomeini finally said they were surrendering in essence, but Saddam was the victor, but at the head of an exhausted country.
So would everything have been okay for Saddam if he hadn't invaded Kuwait?
I think so, and I think he was George Bush Sr. and James Baker wanted to keep Saddam on their side, if you will. They saw Iraq as this huge potential market. American farmers loved Saddam. I mean, they were exporting hundreds of millions of dollars worth of grains to Iraq. The senators from the farm states were visiting Saddam and telling him what a great guy he was.
So did Saddam assume that the United States would go along with his invasion of Kuwait?
Well,
I mean, there's been an awful lot of back and forth as to whether he was actually given a green light.
He was given a green light. Not just there was a famous meeting between him and April Glaspie, the American ambassador to Baghdad at the time. he was given a go-ahead, if you will, not just by her, but by the Assistant Secretary of State, who testified before Congress 2 or 3 days before Saddam invaded Kuwait. He was asked point blank by Lee Hamilton, if Saddam invades Kuwait, what will America do? Do we have any treaty with Kuwait? And the Kelly, who was the Assistant Secretary of State, said, no, we don't. Saddam heard that. And Saddam heard April Glaspie when she said, we're not going to take a position. George Bush wrote a letter to Saddam just a couple of days. George Bush Sr. wrote a letter to Saddam just a couple of days before the actual invasion, when people knew he was massing troops, and did not draw a line in the sand.
Saddam also claimed that Kuwait was sucking up Iraq's oil because I guess there's a sea of oil underneath both countries, but it's mostly on the Iraqi side, and he said it was kind of like
slant drilling, they call it.
Yeah, it was kind of like they were putting a straw into the oil and sucking it all out from the corner.
Well, he said that, but more important was he claimed that Kuwait was trying to break him. In other words, right after the war with Iran ended and Saddam's country is exhausted and desperately in need of oil revenues, Kuwait suddenly upped their oil production. That caused world oil prices to plummet, and it was an incredible blow at Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein tried to get the Kuwaitis to back off. He said, you know, you're killing me. I fought for you for 8 years to protect you guys from Khomeini, which was true. And the Kuwaitis refused to negotiate. It later turned out that the CIA had been meeting with the top Kuwaiti intelligence officials and getting them, convincing them to use their oil policy to weaken Saddam Hussein. So when Saddam thought there was a plot, in effect, he was correct.
Where was the Soviet Union in all of this, Leonid Brezhnev and then Mikhail Gorbachev?
Well, that was another problem. The Soviet Union was breaking up at the time, and so that George Bush Sr. and Baker were looking at what was going on in the Soviet Union. They were not looking at what was going on in the Middle East. And so you had younger people, junior people in their government saying, hey, we got trouble ahead in Kuwait. They paid absolutely no attention to it until it was too late.
My guest is Barry M. Lando. His book, Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, From Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. It is published by Other Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So the United States decides after the invasion of Kuwait that it has to liberate Kuwait, surprising Saddam Hussein, I assume.
Right, surprised him, and then they made it impossible for him to negotiate his way out, too.
And why do you think that is? Because they were trying to topple him?
They wanted to topple him. They wanted to wipe out his Republican Guard, his military forces. And
why, after they had supported them in the war?
Because all along there had been this kind of back and forth among the leadership in Washington about what we ought to do with Saddam. One side was saying, this guy is bad news. Others were saying, no, we should try to win him over. All of a sudden, the win him over side saw that wasn't going to work. And they decided, well, no, we have to destroy Saddam.
And after the Gulf War, when the decision was made to leave him in place, and many people have lauded that decision, weren't we really abandoning the Kurds and the Shiites?
As they were driving Saddam out of Kuwait back in 1991, the George Bush Sr. called for the Iraqi people to rise up and overthrow Saddam. He made that speech a couple of times. That call was relayed throughout Kuwait by the CIA, secret radio stations, throughout Iraq by the secret radio stations of the CIA, and also by millions of pamphlets that were dropped by the U.S. Air Force over Iraq. The Kuwaitis, the Iraqis, heard the call and rose up. The Shiites rose up first. It spread like wildfire across southern Iraq. The Kurds rose up. The Iraqi military started to go over to the sides of the rebels as well, feeling that Saddam was finished. Saddam himself felt he was finished, apparently. And then all of a sudden, George Bush and James Baker began to get worried. This was a rabble that was going to take over, they feared. The Iranians would come in, the Kurds would become independent, the Turks would be upset by that. And so they said, gee, we better put the lid back on. They turned their back on the uprising. They allowed Saddam to continue using his helicopter gunships to attack the rebels. They even ordered American troops not just to not help the rebels. American troops were just a few kilometers away from this uprising. I spoke to one Special Forces officer who told me the rebels came to their lines and said, look, we're not asking you to fight for us. Just give us weapons. The U.S. had hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons they had captured from the Iraqi army. They destroyed those weapons on orders from the Pentagon rather than turn them over to the rebels.
Well, the predictions that were made at the time have borne fruit since the second invasion of Iraq. Do you think that it was inevitable that an American president would feel it was necessary to return to Iraq to oust Saddam?
No, not necessarily.
Well, what about the sanctions? Bill Clinton instituted sanctions.
Well, actually, the sanctions began with the invasion of Kuwait. They were put on right then, and the idea was to force Saddam out of Kuwait. That didn't work. So then, but they continued the sanctions afterwards. First, the idea being that to get the inspectors into weapons inspectors into Iraq, but also the idea was if we can put enough pressure on the people of Iraq, it will cause them to rise up and overthrow Saddam. These sanctions were basically a stranglehold on the economy of Iraq. Absolutely nothing came in or went out. Even medical journals couldn't be imported. Heart attack pills couldn't be imported. Nothing for the medical system, nothing for anything.
But it affected the people. It didn't necessarily affect the leadership.
It affected the people in that, as the United Nations estimated, anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million Iraqis, and most of those were children, died because of those sanctions.
So when Allied forces went in there, do you think that there was already a big residue of resentment? Or because the assumption was in Washington that the invading forces would be treated as liberators.
Yeah, I think there was certainly a residue of resentment, certainly among the Shiites in the South. The Kurds, I mean, everybody had been burned at least once or twice by the Americans. And, of course, with the sanctions, too, the people didn't blame Saddam. They blamed the United States and the British for the sanctions. So, no, this idea that we're going to go in and they're going to throw flowers was totally unrealistic.
What do you think of the surge in troops that's proposed by President Bush? In a recent article in the Los Angeles Times, you wrote, I think it was called The True Accounting of U.S. Forces in Iraq, roughly 100,000 bodies are missing from the equation. The number of American forces in Iraq is not 140,000, but more like 240,000.
That's right. We're leaving out the mercenaries. And there are about 100,000 mercenaries paid. They're called independent contractors who are working for major, like Blackwater and Halliburton, major U.S. companies that are making enormous amounts of money.
But are they fighting?
Some of them are fighting. Some of them are serving as armed guards to American officials. Others serve as cooks, others as engineers, helicopter pilots, but they're doing the same things that the American military used to do. And in fact, what started the first riots going in Fallujah a couple of years ago was not the killing of four or five American soldiers. It was the killing of four or five of these independent contractors. And based on that, George Bush ordered the Marines to attack this city. But these were not soldiers who were killed.
Now, I misidentified that op-ed piece. That was in the Toronto Globe and Mail. But in the Los Angeles Times, you have complained about the debate over civil war. Now, you used to work at CBS. Do you remember how those debates occurred when you decided on what phrase you were going to use to describe a situation in a troubled place?
I've never had a debate like that take place over that particular thing. But I think here it was very heavily political. Once people are willing to say it's a civil war, then, and if George Bush is saying it's not, all of a sudden you've leapt across a threshold, if you will.
Well, NBC and the Los Angeles Times have decided that it is indeed a civil war, but others say things like Iraq is on the brink of or teetering on the edge of civil war. You feel that...
Well, what I did was, as this debate was going on, I simply took a look at the rate of casualties in Iraq these days, and I looked at the rate of casualties in America during the Civil War. And Iraq surpassed America. Iraq has surpassed America right now.
Well, I never did get an answer on whether the surge is working. The latest news out of Iraq is that a successful battle was waged yesterday in Najaf that claimed the lives of 250 insurgents. Doesn't that suggest that the tide may be turning?
I have no idea. I mean, I think when you read even the accounts of that battle, first of all, the American officials there have not confirmed those figures. When you read similar accounts of what is going on the streets of Baghdad now and these supposed joint operations with the Americans and the Iraqis, you get the feeling it's total chaos. No one really knows who's in control. The Americans don't even know who is shooting at them. One recent account said when one unit came under fire and one sergeant was killed, they suspected that the shot had come actually from the Iraqi military, not from any of the insurgents.
It's my sense that this is a case of history repeating itself three or four times in this area. The British went through similar situations a number of times, and we still don't seem to have learned the lesson.
In reading over the last two or three years doing research for this book, you almost come to the conclusion that every time the West, and not just the West, but the Russians also, tried to go into this area using force, undercover, CIA, whatsoever, they've had their heads handed to them. The Russians went into Afghanistan with disastrous results. The U.S. tried to arm a resistance to the Russia. That's now blown back on them. Everything the West has done in that part of the world has really been disastrous.
So this is a mess that is impossible to clean up?
That is impossible to clean up without considerable more bloodshed.
Barry M. Lando's book, Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush, is published by Other Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure.